Coming up in this hour, we're going to be talking to Chris Wilcock, one of those who is an influential leader in music circles in the Catholic Church in Australia. He wrote some of the memorable music for the Australian visit of Pope John Paul II and is also composing material for this year's World Youth Day celebrations. And we begin with one of Chris's compositions, which was ABC Christmas CD of the Year. The Music of Southern Star. That was the ABC CD of the week for Christmas. It was written by an Australian composer, Chris Wilcock. Chris is also a Jesuit priest, and Chris Wilcock is our guest on Sunday night. Chris, welcome to the program.
John, good evening to you, and thank you very much.
It's a bit of a distinction to have your work chosen as the ABC Christmas CD of the week. Of course, the hook for most Australians is that the words to your music were written by sort of Melbourne's sort of cultural icon, one of our national treasures, Michael Lunig.
Well, certainly working with Michael Lunig was no difficulty. Namely, he was a person whose work I've admired for a long time, whose images I think many of us know, but also his words cut to the chase in, I think, a way which makes a thing like Christmas not just a saccharine event, but something which can be expressed and seen and, I think, experienced in a stronger, better way. So, yes, he was a great collaborator.
There's something, too, almost musical about the way Lunig writes his poetry, in that emotionally it has both optimism and pathos mingled.
Mostly, yes. This is what I found in the cycle of poems that he wrote for this piece, which has about 9 poems. A number of them had been published before, but a number of them were written expressly for this project. What I found in looking at the texts and rereading them and trying to digest them is he often plays with contrasts, not just the obvious ones of darkness and light, but joy and grief, with contentment and with despair. So you'll often find in him 2 things that are normally regarded as in conflict or as at different poles, brought together in the one line, and you've got to cope with somehow these 2 conflicting images almost in the same breath.
And always, of course, from the perspective of the common man, the very small I.
That's right. I think in that respect, he responds, in my experience, very closely to some of the lyrics of John Shaw Nielsen, who most people who, in writing about him, speak of him as one of our greatest lyric poets, namely a poet whose texts lend themselves most wonderfully to set to music. And I believe the same might be said of Michael Lunig. His texts lend themselves wonderfully to music, and not just I, but other composers in this country have used Michael's texts for their own compositions.
Where did the idea come from? Where do Chris Wilcock and Michael Lunig intersect?
Well, there was a third party, not exactly a matchmaker, but the idea to write a cycle of Christmas settings came as a result of a discussion I had down in Hobart a number of years ago now, when Marshall McGuire, the harpist, was involved in a concert with the Tasmanian Symphony Orchestra in which a piece by mine was also to be premiered. Marshall and I were there for different reasons, but happened to be on the same program. So we had a drink after the concert, and we're talking about our work and things and what's happening. And the event took place around Christmas time. So Marshall was saying, well, Chris, I mean, you know what it's like. Almost every harpist in this country, whether they're good or whether they're bad, I will almost always get a gig at least once a year around Christmas time. And that is to accompany the Benjamin Britten cycle called A Ceremony of Carols, which is a setting of about 9 carols from the late medieval, early Renaissance English period. And of course, that cycle is sung by many choirs in the English-speaking world now, since they're first written in the 40s. So Marshall was saying, look, Christopher, you have your harp, you're given this gig, you bring it along to the hall, you play the Britten, then you just sit around until the end of the program, because there's nothing else for you to do in that concert. Wouldn't it be great if there was another piece using just the same forces as the Britten, but treating Christmas from an Australian perspective? And I thought the idea was a fantastic one. So after that discussion, I went back home and I thought, well, the person who I would like to approach to prepare such a set of text for a cycle would be Michael Learning. Now, I thought of him because for the last couple of Christmases, I was struck by the text he often wrote to accompany a Christmastide cartoon. So there was the image of Michael that we recognise, but there's also a text that went with those images. And they struck me as being the sort of thing that I'd like to have Michael explore over a longer period, namely in a cycle of poems that would be the basis of the new work.
How did he initially respond? I guess you contacted him and said, oh, Michael, I admire your work. I'd like you to work on this with you.
I did all that. He wasn't easy to find. I mean, you can imagine someone like Michael Learning doesn't allow himself to be found too easily, and I think I can understand why he does that. But once I ran him to his lair and I broached the idea with him, he was immensely enthusiastic, because I think what I was trying to say in my halting way is, I think, something that he was doing in his less halting way, both visually and verbally, in his Christmas cartoon. So the response was instantaneous, and I could tell just by the first meeting that here I'd have somebody that I'd be delighted to work with, and whose work would just be what I wanted.
In a sense, it's redemption being found amidst the crumbs of life, isn't it?
Absolutely, absolutely, absolutely. And all these texts, both the ones that we had chosen from his already existing outbook, as well as those he was writing for me in view of this new project, all belong to that same universe, yes.
Christopher Wilcock is our guest on Sunday night. We're talking about Southern Star, a collaboration with cartoonist and poet Michael Learning. Chris, let's have a listen to another piece from Southern Star. And this is for solo soprano and, appropriately, harp. Just tell us a little bit about this.
Like the Britten model that I was following, Britten wrote his work for young voices, sopranos and altos, either boys' voices or girls' voices. And a number of the carols that he set were set for solos and not just always for the choir. So I thought I'd do one that had a solo voice as well. Yes, it's called The Holy Child. And it may disturb some readers or some listeners when they see that the text says things like, I found no manger, I found no star, I heard no angel, there were no kings. All the things that we think as being essential to the Christmas scene in Michael Learning's image were not there, at least in the voice of the person singing the song. So it's not unlike that old theological stance that was often spoken of as the via negativa, the negative way, by saying what is not there. So by cutting out all the things that are not the essential, the philosopher, the thinker, the seeker finds the one thing that is essential. So by the time you get to the end of the third verse, what Michael has said is, yet in my heart I found the Holy Child. So the whole piece builds up towards that stripping away of what is the appearances before finally reaching the truth and the heart of the matter. That's the basis of this poem, and I hope the basis of the setting of the poem that I made.
From Southern Star and sung by the head choral scholar at Trinity College in Melbourne, Suzanne Shakespeare.
I saw no star, I had no angel.
on Sunday night, the music of Christopher Wilcock from Southern Star. And lest you think it's inappropriate to play the music of Christmas around this time of the year, we should remind people that it is the season of the Annunciation as well. So new birth and death intermingled. Chris, let's talk for a moment about church music generally in Australia and the current state of church music. You're somebody who's been writing in this area for 20 years now, and indeed, when Pope John Paul II came to Australia, one of your pieces, Do Not Be Afraid, I Am With You, was sung by thousands around the country. Quite soon, World Youth Day will be celebrated in Australia. Again, the Pope returning, this time in the person of John Paul's successor, Benedict. Are you involved in this?
To an extent, yes. I've been asked to prepare the entrance song, the song that will be sung as the opening of the Mass that will be held at Randwick at the end of the World Youth Day celebrations. This is the Mass that will gather a huge crowd of people there from all the World Youth Day pilgrims, and I expect it will also be broadcast beyond Randwick to the rest of the world. So I was asked to write a piece that will be used as the entrance, so as the first song that will be sung at the start of that Mass. So I was given the text of the World Youth Day theme, which is all about the Spirit and the witness that we bear to the Spirit. And the young people are charged, I think, with that mission of going out and being spreaders of the good news that the Spirit inspires. So it's called Spirit Whisper, Spirit Shout. And the text is by a colleague of mine, another Jesuit called Andrew Hamilton. So he wrote the text for this song, and I set it to music. And what you'll hear at the end of World Youth Day will be the result of our labours.
Before we have a chance to listen to it, we're in an era where church music has to come to terms with an utterly different sensibility. You go back 50 years, and even up into the era, I guess, when you started to write, if you're writing for a grand ceremonial occasion in church, then that's what it was. I mean, there was pomp, there was circumstance, there was ceremony, there was a choir of 1,000 voices, if you could pull them together, all of them excellently trained singers, and they could do whatever you asked of them, and so could the musicians. It's a radically different church today and a radically different musical culture. You have to adjust to that.
Certainly at the level of where most people who attend church regularly go, that will be the case, namely the parishes. The parishes are not nearly as well-resourced here as perhaps many of them would like, or even many of them in the old days would have had been accustomed to. What you find now is perhaps less involvement by people who are musically skilled, quite apart from there being often less people involved in any case as attenders. There has been quite a change, both demographically and perhaps also artistically as well, yes.
And culturally too, because I guess if you went back, say, two generations, you could find choirs who were locally trained church parish choirs who were skilled in the sort of British choral tradition or even, say, the Italian tradition. What you're getting these days is many sort of multicultural diversities from various Catholic traditions, some of whom wouldn't be familiar with the sort of Western choral tradition at all.
That's certainly true. I think in the old days, though, most of the traditions that would have been heard in church would have been Latin-based, because that was the language of the liturgy. Where there were English hymns sung, they would be more at the devotions rather than at the liturgies. That would have been the most common fare heard in church. Nowadays, of course, with publishing forming such a huge impact on musical life, and most of the English-speaking world's publishing comes from the US, hence much of what is done now in churches would be generated either by US composers or by people like myself who have a US publisher to make the whole publishing game viable, because if numbers are small, sales are small, and no one can survive with small sales. So that's the other factor, I think, John, as well as the broader cultural mix of Filipinos, of Vietnamese, and the other more Catholic, just to stick to the Catholic Church, the other more Catholic countries who are now here by virtue of immigrants coming from those countries and making the mix even more complex than it was in the so-called older days, yes.
So when you're approached to write something for World Youth Day, it's not just the event itself, it's who you're going to have singing it and whether or not it has any ongoing future use. So you have to think in far more radically simple terms, and I don't mean that in terms of your intellectual approach, but I do mean in terms of the structure of the music.
In a sense, yes. In fact, the request that I got to do this entrance song was both to prepare an English version, which is what I did, and then for the verses to prepare multilingual versions. So there are a couple of verses in Italian, a couple of verses in French, a couple of verses in Spanish, which were the three other languages that I was asked to have translated for the purposes of this celebration. But equally, people coming from Africa or from Asia may well have had a claim on their language being represented, but in fact that wasn't the case for this instance, but may well be increasingly the case for jobs down the track.
Let's hear then Chris Wilcock's contribution for World Youth Day, Spirit Power. Spirit Power, the music of Chris Wilcock, commissioned for World Youth Day and soon to be heard around the world via World Youth Day at Randwick in Sydney in just a couple of months' time. Chris Wilcock, continuing this discussion about music and its place in church culture these days, music almost has a role not only as an expression of who we are, but a custodian of where we've come from. There's almost a sort of rich cultural tradition which music bears into the church. In some ways, music conveys doctrine far better than a class in doctrine could. Mm-hmm. Where do you find your resources in approaching that today, how you as a Jesuit and a teacher use music to teach the church? And I'm thinking particularly about the way you've reached back and gone to all sorts of interesting sources. For instance, Francis Thompson, the great 19th century romantic poem, The Hound of Heaven. Why on earth would you reach back to something like that for a musical setting?
That's a very good question. In fact, I didn't choose Francis Thompson. The title of his poem, The Hound of Heaven, was used by editors of one of the most influential English translations of the Psalms for Catholics, the so-called Grail Psalter. Now, the Grail Psalter was a version in English of an earlier vernacular translation, but into French, the so-called Bible of Jerusalem, or the Jerusalem Bible. That work, which was undertaken after World War II, produced a whole translation of the full Bible into French, both the Old and New Testaments. And the Grail settings, the ones that appeared in English, were versions of the Jerusalem Bible that had been pretty well inspired by the work of another Jesuit, a man called Joseph Gelinot, who's a French priest and who worked in the area of trying to make the Psalms both accessible to people in their language, so not in Hebrew but in French in his case, but also accessible in the way that they were sung. So he produced melodies for what he called antiphons, or little phrases that came after each of the verses, as well as psalm tones or psalm patterns that could be fitted to each of the verse translations of the separate psalms, so that a singer, normally a soloist, would be able to sing the verses according to these patterns of psalm tones, and the people could respond with the antiphons or the refrains. Now, that was a massively influential movement in the church in France in the 40s and the 50s, and very soon was picked up in the English-speaking world when they appeared in the so-called Grail translation, the same psalms but set to the music of Gelinot, but in English. Now, that for me was a most important impetus to try my own hand at such a thing.
Yes, the revival of a sense of liturgy in the church was, of course, a very powerful movement that you've chosen to identify yourself with. Mm-hmm. You actually spent some time in Paris, did you not?
Well, in fact, I was living in the same house as Joseph Gelinot. After I was ordained in 1977, I went to France in 1978 to begin my master's and my doctoral work in that city. And in the house was the man about whom I'd just been speaking. He was still teaching then and was both a great friend to me personally, but also a great inspiration artistically and liturgically. So I had not just the man's work, but also had the man himself to to refer to. Yes, he was wonderful and remains a wonderful friend. He's still quite supportive of the things that I'm doing now.
He must be getting on a bit now.
Was born in 1920, so he's coming up for 88 this year. Yes, he's hanging in there.
Well, let's go to one of the Gelinot settings, the Gelinot Psalms, and probably the most popular, Psalm 23, The Lord is My Shepherd.
Par le juste chemin, pour l'amour de son nom.
passerai-je avant de ténèbres, je ne crains aucun mal. Près de moi, ton bâton, ta houlette sont là qui me consolent.
Le Seigneur est mon
The Lord is my shepherd. The Psalms of Joseph Gelinneau, an inspiration to our guest on Sunday night, Christopher Wilcock. The way music changed in the church over the last 60 or 70 years, Gelinneau has an important place in this. Where does he fit?
He, along with many people in France at the end of the Second World War, were very caught up by the movements that had been taking place prior to the Second World War. These were movements based in Belgium, in Germany and in France, where the efforts of many people who were unsatisfied with perhaps the overly clerical nature of the way that, say, Sunday Eucharist was being celebrated, was keeping at a further remove the participation of the people who came to church. Now, people kept on coming to church, but their involvement in the celebration was more at a one-to-one level. I'm here at the presence of the sacred mysteries, and whether there's one person beside me or 300 is, in a sense, immaterial. The effort to try and realign people's imaginations so that they were not coming just for private devotions, but to come to celebrate as a people of God, not just as a private devotion, was a major influence in those years prior to the war and after the Second World War. So someone like Gelinneau, in his efforts to get texts that were normally said in Latin into French, for example, into the vernacular of his country, was one step in that movement to try and get people to sing together rather than having just a soloist or a choir sing in the stead of the people. This was not to downgrade soloists or choirs, but it was to incorporate all the members of the celebration together so there weren't walls built up between those who sang and those who didn't sing, between those who spoke and those who didn't speak. So much of this came about in the interwar period and in the immediate post-war period, so that by the time that the Second Vatican Council started in 1963, many of these movements had gained not just academic strength, but popular strength. At the time of the Council, there were many, many movements pushing towards a renovation of the liturgy, a renewal of the liturgy that took much more serious account the active, full, conscious participation, in other words, they used, of the entire body of the faithful in celebration.
Dangerously democratic stuff.
I know. Now, not every result that it produced was good, just as not every result that was produced in the earlier times in the masses after Trent was good either. But I think the movement itself, though, produced some extraordinarily, I think, positive and wonderful growing points in the church, and not just the way the church worships, but the way the church is managed and the way the church is seen by the world.
Christopher, listening to a psalm like that, that then prompts you as a composer yourself into your own reflections, which brings us back to the Hound of Heaven.
Yes, well, the Hound of Heaven, as I said, I was struck by the title that the editors of the English translation used at the top of Psalm 139, so it's got nothing to do with the psalm writer. That was purely an editorial addition to the translation. And, of course, as you mentioned earlier, the Francis Thompson poem, which bears the same title, speaks of the same thing, namely that wherever we go or whatever we do, we are never out of the sight or the range of God.
Yes, the divine pursuit, I think it's been referred to as.
That's right. Well, this is it. And the psalmist speaks about this impossibility as a human being and as a creature of God to escape the Creator. And that rather terrifying prospect in Francis Thompson's poem becomes a very reassuring prospect in the words and the mouth of the Hebrew psalmist, yes.
The Hound of Heaven, Chris Wilcock.
Oh, my spirit. Oh, test me and know my thoughts. Oh, make me not walk in evil, but lead me in the way of truth.
You're on Sunday Night on ABC Radio Around Australia. John Cleary with you. Chris Wilcock, let's turn now to some of your other works and the personalities of, you've associated with in Australia and some of the artists you've worked with. One of the best known, I guess, is the Australian poet James Macaulay and some of his works that you've set to music. Other artists are people like Merlin Quaife, who you've often worked with. How much involvement do you have and how much inspiration do you get from where contemporary secular music is? Because contemporary secular music in many ways seems to really be divorced from participation. In classical music, it's so refined that you almost have to develop a distinct taste for it. And even in popular music, it's music to be performed by artists, not to be participated in by the spectators.
You've opened up, I think, a very, very big area here, John. When people ask me what do I do as a composer, writing both for the church and also for the concert hall, how do I reconcile those two apparently contradictory claims? My quick response, and it's not unreflected, but my quick response is that working in both areas keeps me honest in both. Namely, I never feel as though I'm able to get away with, to use that phrase, less than fully crafted work for my church music that I knew I could not get away with in a concert hall with critics and with discerning listeners always there to pick up what you're saying. But neither in my concert work do I feel as though I can retreat into some ivory tower and just creating notes for myself and who cares what the audience think or say. So both, if you like, both constituencies, the church constituency and the concert hall constituency, constitute for me a wonderful balance and counterbalance to each other to keep me honest as a composer. Now, that will have various forms in the various works that I'm writing, whether it's a simple psalm or whether it's a more complex piece for church. But equally, my writing for the concert hall will also keep me fully aware of who is the music written for. It's not just for me, the composer, but for the people to whom the music has been directed and who will pick it up and take it up according to their own lights and experiences and make of it what they will.
On whose shoulders do you feel you stand most musically, though? I mean, we've spoken about people like Gelinow and their influence on you, but in a direct musical tradition that has to work in a secular arena as well, yeah, on whose shoulders do you stand? Where do you draw from?
It's another big question, John. Again, let me give you the beginnings of an answer. When I began my studies at the University of Sydney in composition, it may not have been the same day, but I certainly arrived around the same time as a student at the university as Peter Sculthorpe arrived as a teacher. Now, as I said, I don't think we came through the same door at the same time, but we were close enough to that. So I had, as the mentor of my years doing the undergraduate work in composition, a man as wonderfully attuned to the universe, to our culture, to our region, and to wider Australian influences there for me as my teacher. And I was a young student who'd been trained very, very well by a man called William Lovelock, who was an English pedagogue who's based here in Australia for a number of years, wrote many, many books in the area of music teaching, in composition, orchestration, and so forth. So I'd come to the university with a very good background in the techniques of the composer's art. But when I went to the university and met people like Peter Sculthorpe and working with other composers, people like Anne Boyd and Barry Cunningham, who were also students in the same years, my perspectives obviously broadened immensely, and I didn't retreat from my classical or my, if you like, more traditional conservative training, but what was there already was now open to a whole variety of experiences and influences that I hadn't even suspected when I was still at school.
Who do you admire most? I mean, who do you sit down and listen to when you've got a few hours to spare and you say, I just need to immerse myself in a little music that's not my own?
It would never be hard to put on Yet More Bach. What do I mean, Yet More Bach? I mean, I haven't got to the end of Bach yet, so I can't even say I got through him once. You know, the man's skill, the man's range of experiences, his wonderful dance-like qualities. I mean, even in his somber and less outwardly cheerful music, there's a vibrancy, there's a rhythm, there's a pulse in Bach's music, as well as invention and skill and expertise in the management of notes and lines and harmonies, treatment of the voice, treatment of various instruments. When a person says that they've finished learning everything from Bach, that person is well and truly dead, I'd say.
And in contemporary Australian composers, who excites you? If you look around, people who've been writing over the last 20 years or so in Australia, and you mentioned Sculthorpe as a mentor, and you mentioned Barry Cunningham, but of the others around these days, who would you say, well, that's interesting, I like what they're doing?
Well, there are some great figures, people like Carl Vine and Richard Mills. I mean, these are people who are both influential in the way that music is made in this country because of their administrative roles, but also they're active and fully inventive composers. Major works, symphonies, operas, substantial works that both say a lot and also demand a lot of the listener. But in their demands and in their diction, what you get back in return as a response to them is, I think, a lot for the listener. So
Is there a culture among Australian composers? I mean, we're a pretty scattered population, really, still in Australia, because we haven't got the base of population to build up sort of collaborative communities of artists. But is there a general community amongst composers, any sense of community?
I'd like to think that there was. Most of the contacts that I have are all informal. I mean, I don't belong to any composers' association, though I know that the one or two such exist. All the contacts that I have with other composers have been built up just by being around and a composer. And if you keep on doing good work and don't get forgotten, and you keep up contact with people like your own peers or younger composers or older composers, something like that does sustain itself. I know in the old days when, again, after the Second World War, when the lines were drawn between those who followed the Darmstadt, you know, the Pierre Boulez, the highly intellectual and quite demanding approach to composition. And if you're in that school, you're okay. If you're out of that school, nobody would dare play you or dare program you. So in those days, in the 50s, 60s, even the 70s, there were quite strong lines drawn in the sand. And depending upon which side of the line you stood, were you played or not played, or were you talked to or not talked to? Nowadays, thank God, I think the mix has become so massive and so widespread that those lines in the sand have been rubbed out.
It's okay to be a romantic once again.
I think it always should have been, but it always hasn't been. Yes, yes. Or somebody who writes quite difficult music whose audiences will be of their nature, not large scale, not Sydney Cricket Ground or Melbourne Cricket Ground full of people, no. Mm. But the variety of people who are doing music now, making music, particularly with the advent of the various technologies that are now available, so young people who are able to wield these new instruments can produce musics, plural, that would have been very, very difficult or very, very expensive in the days when, if you had anything of an electronic medium, it was had to be funded by some large corporation or large institution. Now, anybody can make music in their backyard or in their back shed.
And mix it as well.
And mix it, yeah, and sell it. And
publish it. Yes.
Publish it through iPods, the whole lot. It's changed massively, I think, John, that more enclosed coterie of the elect, the composing elect, those walls have been shattered. And the coming and the going, the toing and the froing of people into that space now makes the whole business much more open and, I think, much more exciting.
Chris Wilcock, you have a whole other life as a Jesuit priest, and the Jesuits are known not so much for contemplation and reflection, but for getting out there and mixing it both intellectually and socially. The Jesuit Refugee Service is one of the best known in Australia. Intellectually, Jesuits sort of constantly mount the platform in defence of the church or civil rights. How do you mix the two?
Well, our founder, a man called Ignatius of Loyola, tried to put the two things together. He called us contemplatives in action. So that's the difficult task that each of us who is a Jesuit tries to live out. So we're supposed to bring to our work, to our activities, whether it's teaching, composing, astronomy, poetry, digging farms or running schools, the fruits of our reflection, the fruits of our meditation, the fruits of our contemplation. So the two aspects of our lives are supposed to be in harmony with each other. That, I suppose, is one of the aspects of Jesuit life which I, as a composer, try to embody, namely what I do when I'm writing music or working with people who are bringing my music to life or to birth, comes out a result of my being able to address the questions that the music presents to me. Now, sometimes it's a text I'm setting, or if there's no text there, with the idea behind the music, the non-verbal music. As you say, the work of the Jesuit Refugee Service, which was basically begun here in Australia by our current provincial man called Father Mark Raper. He was the first director of that organisation. It's now worldwide, and it does fantastic work in many, many countries where people's lives disturbed by civil war or other forms of conflict or violence have forced them on the road of the refugee. After they celebrated 25 years of this work, I was asked, again with my friend Father Andrew Hamilton, the man who wrote the text for Spirit Power, to write a song that could be used to celebrate those 25 years. So Andrew, as ever, produced a fantastic text. I'm not sure, as ever, tried to match him with my music. So that is one effort at the artistic level to try and not just celebrate, but also to push our work forward in the area of working for those who are refugees or migrants in strange lands. Yes.
A song from Andrew Hamilton and Chris Wilcox, Who Did You See? Celebrating 25 years of Jesuit Refugee Services. The music of Chris Wilcox on Sunday night on ABC Radio. Who Did You See?
No heart.
we're rapidly running out of time, Chris Wilcock, but let's finish with a piece that really one must associate with Easter, the season that we've recently passed through. And this is going back to your interest in Australian culture too. It's James Macaulay's words, sung by Merlin Quaife and conducted by Richard Mills. So I guess it's appropriate bringing this together. Pietà, just tell us about it.
Pietà is a sonnet. I was asked by Merlin to write a setting of a poem for her. She was giving a concert, this is years ago now, in Germany. Now, I think I got the details correct, but if I haven't, it still is, I think, a good story. Merlin was overseas at the stage. She contacted me here in Australia, said, Christopher, do you have anything in your bottom drawer that I can sing in Berlin in 2 weeks' time? They want me to include an Australian piece in my programme, and I haven't got one with me in my suitcase. Dear Merlin, yes, I think I can find something here. I was at that stage with my family at Christmas time up in Armidale, New South Wales. On my brother's bedside table, there was a book of James Macaulay poems. I flipped through it to find one that I thought might fit. A sonnet is a nice length. The language was sufficiently clear that for a non-native English-speaking audience, they should be able to catch much of what Macaulay was saying. So I said, right. Now, Merlin, I phoned her, I think, where will you be in a week's time? So she told me that she'd be in Paris. So I said, right, give me a contact in Paris. So I wrote the piece in those few days, sent it to Paris, and she learned it, I think, on the train between Paris and Berlin and premiered it that next week in Berlin. So at least that's the story as I recall it now.
Oh, and that's the story that deserves to be passed into legend. It's absolutely, absolutely.
So that's how it got its launch. Then the piece, which was written for voice and for organ originally, I then orchestrated the organ part for strings, and it's that version which you'll hear now.
Chris Wilcock, great to have you with us on Sunday night. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, John.
And we shall finish now with James Macaulay's words, Merlin Quaife, voice, and the conducting art of Richard Mills. Chris Wilcock's Pietà. the voice of Marilyn Quaife, and the music of Christopher Wilcock on Sunday night.